with my church family here, and I was in exile in Texas. I'm just kidding there, too. I was playing with my grandchildren, so hopefully you understand. And Louisville, I bring you greetings from the congregation at Louisville, and that's where I've been for a while, and sorry I missed being with you on these Lord's Days. Hope you're having a blessed Lord's Day. I have to admit, I thought the Alabama humidity was bad until I went to Texas and then the heat. So I'm toying between which is worse, the humidity or the pure unadulterated heat. It was 99 and felt like 129 the way it was, but there you go. Hope you are in good health. Hope you're feeling well. If we have visitors today, please know we are honored, and we are studying the Gospel of John, and you have gone past me, and we are in chapter 4, even though I know full well that that's not where Doug got last week. I need to explain why I'm skipping the couple of very important narratives that we'll come back and do next Lord's Day. So chapter 3 in particular, Nicodemus, if you know the narrative, the story already, and the woman at the well. So those two very important narratives are in chapter 3 and beginning of chapter 4. There is a reason for which I dare to skip ahead in the narrative. Let me say this. The gospel writers, inspired as they are left the freedom from time to time to tell not only the story the way they saw it, and it's protected from error, but both the wording and the terminology and the points they want to emphasize, the gospel writers are left to do that. That's the wonderful way in which God inspired these eyewitnesses of the life of the Son of God on earth 20 centuries ago. They don't contradict each other. They are able to tell different things. The first miracle, turning the wine into water into wine, is not mentioned by any of the other writers. And the woman at the well, a very important incident, is told by John. Remember, John tells a story about 60 years after it happened, while Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the synoptic gospels, tell the story about 30 years after it happened. Both of those, you could say, sets of gospels, the 3 and the 1, are doing it because the apostles are dying out. The living witnesses, those who were there, those who are eyewitnesses, start dying out, and thus they want to leave a recorded, God wants a recorded record of what his son did and what he said, and that's where we are at. I'm skipping ahead to chapter 4 and verse, well, we're going to start right there with 46, an event that's narrated by John because of an event that happened this week, to be honest with you. So it was in Louisville. I left on a Thursday, I got to Texas, and then on a Saturday morning I was with a soccer field with my grandchildren playing. There's nothing more hilarious than see 5-year-olds try to chase a ball. They're usually chasing butterflies, and they're going the wrong direction, and parents telling them good job when there's a melee of small children just kicking each other's shins. And you're going, what sport is that? But it's the beginnings of soccer, if you've ever seen it. It's a kind of a new sport to the U.S. There was a wonderful family right in front of where I was standing, cheering on my grandchildren. I had 3 that were playing that day, and their names are Mitch and Leah, and they had 2 beautiful daughters, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. The 5-year-old was playing on the field. I was impressed by the 3-year-old, who was not playing but was looked like a little person in a small body, or an adult in a small body. I don't know if you've ever seen those, but cute as all get-outs. And I looked at this little girl, people way interacted with them, and I thought, wow. And then I looked over and I saw the parents sitting down, and the mother was obviously in the last stages of pregnancy. And I asked about this third child that God was gifting them that was coming along. And then what proceeded was a sad narrative. Well, it's a boy. His name is Nate. And he's due any time. But he's been diagnosed with a disease whose name I can't even pronounce. I had to look it up on the phone, and I already know cleft palate, a few other things. I don't know what the technical term was, but something to the effect of will not be able to sustain life. Something to that effect. And that's, of course, just So all the joy of seeing the grandchildren just was replaced by this sadness for this woman that was sitting in a chair in front of me, who already knew that she was going to, there was no chance. The little boy, the first boy, she had two girls, but what, all the thoughts that come to your mind, what kind of strength does that take, you know, to carry to term? Because that's what she had to do. Didn't know how many days, how many weeks. Carry to term, because that's what was best, the doctor said, not to C-section or anything like that. And then to find out that they were members of the church, too. And then, you know, I saw him the next day on Sunday morning sitting in a pew in front of me. And so from the back, I saw the interaction of the parents and the two girls. And then this sadness, this weight on me, just a visitor from outside on the reality of this this event. Wow, what would it take? Now, some of you have lost not only loved ones, maybe you lost a child. I've told you before, I lost a son. I got to hold him for 10 minutes in my arms. His name was Christopher, and he would be 37 today. So actually, I wanted to say to her, I think I understand a little bit, you know, because when I got that diagnosis of my first son, that he had died in the womb in the last stages of the pregnancy, and that my wife's going to have to spend 10 hours in labor giving birth to a son that would not live, it was not alive anymore, you know, then all of that, all those memories, because, you know, you kind of life happens. What has happened since 1980 is that God has blessed me with 6 children. You see, if we could see the rest of the picture the way God did, that was my first son, so the loss was all those memories of the feelings of that, and of course, with Kim, too. Christopher would be 37. Nate was born Monday, last Monday. So during the week as it played out, Nate was born. And he was not living, not breathing, at least. And so there's a sense in which that's a blessing. But then they asked the mother, Leah, if she wanted to hold the child. She said yes. And in an amazing moment, when they laid the child on the mother's, the child came alive and started breathing. Nate breathed. He took a breath. And Nate breathed for about 24 hours. And he died on a Wednesday morning early. His funeral is tomorrow. So, wow. That's a true story. Those are the kind of stories that impact you, make you think of, wow. That's why I've gone to John chapter 4, verse 46. I had to explain it to you. Sorry it took so long. But it's a real story. Pray for them. They sat in front of me Wednesday night, Sunday night. That family was right there, and so I'm very much on my mind. Pray for Mitch and Leah and their two daughters as they move on. But there is Nate that was with them for just a brief time, 24 hours, and then he's gone on. Well, this is the story of a father 20 centuries ago, for whom nothing else mattered. We're in John chapter 4. Please interrupt me anytime if you have a comment. This is the text. You are probably not ready for it. I apologize for that. But this is the event that led me to skip ahead, and we'll go back to John 3 and John 4 later. But I'd like you to turn there. Your son lives. This is the basic theme of the narrative. One of the many events. The gospel writers don't have time to tell us all the events that happened during the 3 years of Jesus' ministry, but they tell us some. And this is one of them. It's recorded in inspired scripture, and it has some interesting moments here. So we are back in Galilee. Jesus has been down to Jerusalem. In the 3 years approximately of Jesus' ministry, remember, don't do 12 times 3. It's somewhere around 3 years. He goes down to Jerusalem 3 times. The third time he will not exit Jerusalem. He will die. The Passover feast is the biggest feast for a Jew. And so the journey is made from those that are in Galilee down to the temple of God, the house of God in Jerusalem, to offer sacrifices. And Jesus takes his apostles each time. And that's something that is evident from the reading of all three. This is the year of popularity, the second year, as best I can tell, in the life of Christ. So a little more obscure in the first year, lesser known, but by the second year, massive crowds follow him everywhere and meet him from morning till night. But he's come out of Judea, down south, come from Jerusalem, and he's come back. Remember, Jesus doesn't have a problem with walking through Samaria. All Orthodox Jews do. It's a rule. If you're an Orthodox Jew, don't go through Samaria. What you do is you go around. You go on the other side of the Jordan River, and you walk through Perea, and then you go into Jerusalem. You do a circle instead of a straight line because of that 350-year-old. The Samaritans are off limits. They intermarried, which it was condemned by God, but now that stigma has been left. Jesus is going to break that one and say, no, the gospel is for all. It's for the Samaritans too. And that's the account of the woman on the well at the beginning of this chapter. So Jesus is back in Cana, and he's going to meet a politician, a royal official. When I say politician, we confuse things a little bit because we try to separate politics from religion. It doesn't always work so well, but separation of state and church is something we believe in. But of course, they didn't. First century did not separate the two at all. And that was one of the, of course, big problems. The Romans weren't just the Romans, the dominators. They were also pagans, and they had pagan gods. The Jews were subjects, as were most of the people in that time of Rome, and they had their own god, which the Romans had left them. And the mixture of politics and religion is something that kind of plays out here. Very much. We're going to read the narrative in just a second. I believe that an exchange that's going to be had here between Jesus and a father who's about to lose his son is an important narrative that can help us, Mitch and Leah, and the rest of us who are left there. What on earth can I say to comfort someone like that? I chickened out. I didn't know what to say to Leah. She sat in front of me, and I wanted to say, I think I understand a little bit, but I left my wife to do more of that, to go and try to comfort someone who already knew. And then in that extra gift of 24 hours of getting to hold Nate while he breathed until God took him home in that particular occasion. So let's read chapter 4 and beginning with verse 46 through 54. I'm reading from the New American Standard. I hope you read from whatever version is familiar or good for you. I'm reading from 46 to 54, and if you would, read it in yours. Therefore, he came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine, and there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went on to him and was imploring him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, watch this. Unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe. The royal official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus said to him, go, your son lives. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and started off. As he was now going down, his slaves met him, saying that his son was living. So he inquired of them the hour when he began to get better. And then they said to him, yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him. So the father knew that it was at that hour in which Jesus said to him, your son lives. And he himself believed in his whole household. This is, again, a second sign that Jesus performed when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. Herodians. Herodians were a sect of Jews of the time that were strongly in favor of a larger function, place within politics and power in the area of Judea, the Herodians. They wanted Herodian kings to have a larger role. Most Jews hated the Herodian kings. They had been around the Herodian dynasty for, of course, that refers to Herod the Great, who had been put in power by Rome in about 41 before Christ. He had grown up in Rome. He was a Romanophile, loved everything the Romans did, thought the way they did politics and everything else. He was an Idumean. He wasn't a pure blood. He wasn't considered a pure blood Jew. So he was despised for a couple of reasons. He was in cahoots with the Romans, and he wasn't a full blood Jew. Herod the Great died. Of course, he tried to kill the Son of God. He was jealous enough to want to kill a child that might grow up to be a better king than he. And so that's the intent there. We'll look on the strange, dysfunctional family of the Herodian dynasty, and what you'll find is Herodias Antipas right there. He's one of the three that will have a crown on his head. Herod the Great dies, and he has three sons, and none of the three are really as good at using power or abusing power as he is. So the Romans see that they are going to need to split things up. The Romans don't micromanage. They macromanage. All they care about is they keep the peace and pay the taxes. So they let local rulers, the Herodians, they let them. You want a king? Have a king. Except that the Jews said, we didn't choose them, and we don't like them either. And they took taxes from them. And Herod the Great had done over 20 palaces everywhere. And he had abused of his power, killing babies in the little village of Bethlehem and other abuses of powers like that. So Herodians wanted these guys to have a larger role within Jewish society. Most Jewish people did not want that at all. Now, I don't know for sure that this guy was a royal, it's called a royal, connected to Herod Antipas, okay? I don't know exactly what his function was, this father, in the narrative here. He was in politics. He was on the side of the Herodian kings. Herod Antipas in particular was the one that ruled up there where he was in Galilee. And that's what he did for a job, for a living, and that's who he was. That, all of that is contained in that term royal. So please understand, this is a guy that played with royalty, whose career and life was built around money and power. Except that his son got sick. Now, I don't know the disease. Malaria was a disease in ancient time that was deadly. He has a fever, the child does. By the way, there are two terms in Greek that are used in this text. One is called him son, but the next time when the father interrupts Jesus, Jesus gives a surprising rebuke to the people around him, not to the father, but to the people around him. He seems to not hear, could you do something for my son? The next time that the father speaks of his boy, he says, my child. He uses a different term, which is very interesting in the narrative, when he interrupts Jesus to say, do something, please. So, where does this happen? Cana. 20 miles from Capernaum. So see, please, Cana, right up here. This is the second time. This is where Jesus has been living, over here at Capernaum. He's been down to Jerusalem, and he's come back up. And Nazareth, his hometown, is right there. It just so happens that in the lesson this morning, we're going to go to Nazareth because the lesson's out of Mark 6. But on this occasion, we're in Cana of Galilee, and there's a royal politician connected to the Herodian dynasty. The son's at the point of death. The fever is high. I don't know, again, the source of the disease, malaria or whatever. But of course, those who are older and those who are youngest, children, are the most susceptible to diseases. And in that time, they didn't have quinine and other types of ways of handling. And then if you get to where your fever's too high, dehydration was a real problem at the time. One of the questions that arises is, Mark, another gospel, talks about the Herodians being in cahoots with the Pharisees because this is the second year of Jesus, and they've had enough. They've had enough of Jesus already in the second year. Now, they're not going to get him till the third, but they're going to start determining that this guy is not one of us. He's not the Messiah. They refuse that. And being very violent in their plans for him. A plot. Mark chapter 3 and verse 6, if you find it, finds that the Pharisees and the Herodians, which I think this guy is, had been in a plot to kill Jesus. So what if, I'm just asking the question, I don't know for sure, what if this guy had been either involved in or knew about or in cahoots with the plot to kill Jesus before? What does that say about him? What does that say? What's he doing coming to Jesus to ask for something on this particular case? The story goes of Ronald Reagan. It was shot in 1981. Most of you remember that day. Maybe you do. We've had assassinations in our political history and attempted assassinations. So the story goes that when he was being taken in for surgery, was it one bullet or more? I can't remember. But it was serious. That he asked the surgeon before they put him under the mask, the gas, Ronald Reagan asked him, are you a Republican? this is not about politics, but I'm saying, you kind of want to know. The answer that the surgeon gave him was, today we are all Republicans. I like that answer. Regardless of what you voted last time around, today my job is to save you. That's all that matters right now. I remember when I went under, some of you know that, if you're not so sure about the outcome, if that's ever been your case, then, the person that's right before your go out, you want to say, okay, here's what I asked the anesthesiologist at UAB before my open heart surgery. I asked him, are you a believer? That's what I asked. Because I'd rather have somebody who both knows how to put the right amount of gases in to knock you out and bring you back, and one that prays. What about you? Do you ask your nurse, your surgeon, do you rely on both your skills that you learned in medical school, and you rely on God too? Because what I could use right now is reassurances with regard to that. So the term that's used in the original text, and the way that John narrates it, in the Greek, is he continued to ask Jesus. There is continued action, the tense of the Father. So let's suppose for a minute that we know he was involved in the plot with a group of Herodians that was plotting with the Pharisees to kill Jesus. But now it's personal. Now it's personal. Now his son is sick. And he's at the point of death. And that changes. Well, it should change something. If you're a feeling person, when it gets personal, it should change something. So, I don't know about you, but, if you were teaching this, what would you say about those words that come out of Jesus' mouth as the Father asks him to heal? What would you say? There's shock. There's got to be shock. I mean, the guy just said, my child is dying, can you do something? And Jesus says, you read the verses here. Unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe. Is he looking at the Father when he says this? Or is he looking at the people, the audience, the subjects around? Oh, you want another miracle? Now, I don't think he's questioning the Father. But he is. He's been doing miracles for a year and a half. You would think that all of Galilee by now would get it. I mean, what other sign would you like? They will tell him in the third year, they will say, give us one more sign. And then that's when he will say, no more signs, except for the sign of Jonah. That's the last sign you're going to see. Of course, Jonah is a reference to, I'm going to be dead for 3 days like Jonah was in the belly of the fish, and I'm going to come back. That's the last time you're going to see. Then you're either going to believe or you're not. But I'm not here to, I'm like an entertainer to do things for you. I don't think he is chastising the Father. But, what had been the attitude of the Father before his son got sick? Had his father just viewed Jesus as just a miracle worker who, however, my sect, the Herodians, and my contacts in politics with Herodian kings has rejected the Messiah? Is that the way it is? And so there you go. A rebuke. Jesus gives a rebuke. And the first reaction you might have is, there seems to be a lack of compassion here. But clearly, and this is where I like to put, while our losses and our concerns in a physical sense here on earth are clearly something that the incarnation of God screams. God became flesh. And not only did he become flesh, but he lived as a construction guy. And he experienced hunger and lack of sleep. And while we don't have any record of diseases, we have a full record of how he died. And that was the worst way that any human being can die. By all accounts, in the first century, that's the worst way. So he's going to experience that. So we already know that. Lack of compassion on the part of Jesus, watch out. He is saying, however, I understand how right now all you can see is your son. And he's sick and he's going to die. But this is even more important than that. That son will be healed. He will live out, we don't know the rest of the story, another 30, 40, 50 years, I don't know, something like that. But then that son will die eventually. Yeah. The question is, what's more important? Jesus is trying to say here in the context when I believe he already knows he's going to heal the boy from a distance, but he needs to tell the people, look, your biggest concern should be about your relationship with God. Your biggest concern is that. I understand the physical concerns for sick relatives, children, loved ones. Sometimes we may find ourselves as Christians pursuing more comfort in life. Or I can put it another way, lack of pain. I'd like to not have troubles. I'd like to not have rheumatism. I'd like to not have cancer. I'd like to not have a child diagnosed with whatever that disease was that had him live a day and then he was gone. That's what I'd like. I'd like not to lose my first son. I'd like things to be different than that. And Jesus here, in that context, a very emotionally dense, tense context of humanity that screams about pain and death and loss, he says, make sure that you understand that the biggest issue here is relationship with God. I was impressed. Mitch and Leah were there every service. Brought their two daughters, even though, you know, this cloud was just until last Sunday morning. And then Monday came. Baby came early. That's a blessing. Then there was 24 hours. And by Wednesday, we all knew the rest of the story or the end of the story with regard to the little Nate who was in this world for a day and didn't stand a physical chance at least. When we talk to people, when we minister to people that are hurting and at loss and dealing with disease and other, do we go past trying to help them in their emotional discomfort? Do we go past that? Because our suffering and our dying and the hurt and all that only can make some sense in the context of a larger picture of eternity and where we are with God. That's the only way, you know. You can think it a platitude if you're not a believer or in Christ. Most of us are, but to say, look, I lost my mother, I lost my son, I'm going to see them again. You can think that to be a platitude, but I stand here assured of that. Now, there'll be no marrying and taking marriage in heaven. I understand that. There'll be no father and son and daughter in heaven. Those kind of human relationships are not going. There's going to be a much better situation as best as we can understand from that. But that said, do we move past just giving emotional comfort to people that are at a loss here? I'm going to read you a little text from a writer of, and this is from a little booklet in 1972 by the name of, his name is Henry Nguyen. He said this, a minister, that by the way, that's not just somebody who has an official title of minister. Minister is what all of us are. All of us are ministers, okay? A minister is not a doctor whose primary task is to take away pain. Perhaps the main task of the minister is to prevent people from suffering for the wrong reasons. Many people suffer because of the false supposition on which they have based their lives. That supposition is there should be no fear in life, no loneliness, no confusion or doubt. But these sufferings can only be dealt with creatively when they are understood as wounds integral to our human condition. Therefore, ministry is a very confronting service. Not just good words, but confronting. I didn't feel any need to have to confront Mitch and Leah. They were amazingly handling it like people who know the meaning of this loss of a son. It does not allow, continues the writer, people to live with the illusions of immortality or wholeness. No. We live in a broken world. Sin came into it. And that's why we have what we have. But the promise of a home in heaven is the most amazing thing in this particular case. So, what does... And I'd like, of course, I welcome your comments and agree or disagree here, but when people are confronted with death, it opens their eyes to, whether it's their own or their young child's, it's a test. It's a test of, okay, how do you give meaning to it? Where do you put it, okay? And it does absolutely bring out, okay, what are your biggest concerns right now? What are your greatest concerns? On this day, this beautiful day of July 23rd, when you drove up this morning, for this occasion, what are your biggest concerns? What are your greatest concerns, okay? Jesus gives a rebuke. You need to be, he says to the people around there, you need to be more concerned about your relationship with God the Father and quit wanting another miracle. But I don't think he's talking to the Father. The Father interrupts Jesus, okay? And he calls his son child. Instead of huios, it becomes paideion. There's a change of terms, at least in the Greek text here. Of course, Jesus spoke in Aramaic, but that said, when John, inspired, uses the term, he changes terms, which is kind of interesting. When he came to Jesus to ask, he was saying, forget politics. Forget human power and money. For him to come to Jesus, since Jesus was somebody that his sect had already decided needed to die, for him to come to him was saying, forget my career. I love my son more than I love politics and human endeavors. He knows that when he comes. He knows that. So, but he comes with the attitude of, listen, I love my son enough that I'll give everything up. I've got nothing to lose by coming to you and asking you to heal my son. But his faith has to grow from I've got nothing to lose. I don't know where you are this morning. I've got nothing to lose being a Christian. But our faith has to grow out of I've got nothing to lose. It has to go to something bigger than that. And the text, the narrative, the conversation here clearly goes, you see the faith of this father go from I've got nothing to lose by coming to ask you to heal my son since I've heard you do miracles, and it grows to something more than that. Notice, please, that if you can heal, if you have those powers, Jesus doesn't need to make a 20-mile journey to go. He simply speaks it, kind of like God who spoke into, with just his word, spoke in the creation of universes and billions of stars and our world and the mountains, just a word. And he said it, and it was. And this is the Son of God who simply from 20 miles away said it happened. And of course we know that because the Father checks on what time the next day all of this take place. Now, one thing in the narrative that's important is this. Jesus says it, but he doesn't physically see it till the next day. The Father does not, I don't know what detained him. It said it was the seventh hour. By Jewish clock, you had 7 to 9 o'clock, and what you got, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 20-mile journey. So it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon when he interrupts Jesus as he's rebuking the crowds about their lack of faith, and he says, do something for my son, come to my home. And then Jesus said, it's done. But he doesn't get to his house till the next day. Imagine the distance of time. Have you ever had a diagnosis, an accident happen to a relative, a friend, a loved one, or whatever, and you don't know the outcome for a while, right? Have you ever had that happen? That space of time between when it happens and when you know that they're going to be all right? Do you know that space of time? That's his father. Jesus says at 4 o'clock, but that's in one village. 20 miles away is his home. He's got to go home. He didn't get there till the next day. That's the night. The night, you know. Nighttime is one of my grandchildren had nightmares during our stay there, you know. They hear that cry in the nights, you know. This is an adult who can't travel during the dark, so he travels a little bit, then the next day he does the rest. But the night is where can't sleep. You know, I'm injecting things in the text. I understand that right now, but how do you think he spent that night? Here's where the faith of I don't have anything to lose grows to something bigger than that. And I guess I'd like to know that my faith on this particular day is better than, well, I don't have anything to lose by being a Christian, to being something stronger than that. Stronger than that. The night. The time when doubts assail us, we can't sleep. My daughter was in an accident at Fried Hartman, Chelsea. I was just with her in Texas, and I got a phone call, and it said she had been a flag football game, and she had flipped over a player, landed on the ground, and couldn't walk. Here's your 18-year-old daughter. She can't walk. And so all those thoughts that come in, you know, what am I going to do to my house? How am I going to build a ramp? She's going to be in a wheelchair. You know, all those things for 3 hours. It didn't spend a whole night, but 3 hours, because they injected something. And then 3 hours later, she moved her toes for the first time. And suddenly there's that realization. Oh, it was just a bruise on the spinal cord. It wasn't a full break. But for 3 hours. So here's this father walking home. How much faith do we have about, you know, dying and the pain and the cancer, and how much faith have we matured, hopefully past I don't have anything to lose by being a Christian, to know I know, I trust, I am assured, all of the above, okay? Jesus said it, but the Father didn't know it till the next day. That's the difference between a promise and fulfillment. There's a sense in which we know already that God is, of course, on this earth, that Jesus was the Son of God, and I state it unequivocally. But when the end of time comes, of course, my death may happen before that, but when the end of time comes, not only I'll know it, everybody will know it. And that's when all of those promises will be fulfilled. A home in heaven, a better situation, reunited with those in Christ that have gone on before, which is what 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 says, will be reunited. Those that have died in Christ, all the martyrs and all, will be taken up, and will be reunited with those that are living in Christ right then. So, a very different thing. Maybe this story wasn't as meaningful to you, but it screamed at me from the experience of Mitch and Leah this week, and I hope that it was meaningful to you. Maybe we can relate. I'm trying to read the story. There was that night that the Father spent between hearing what Jesus said and knowing that it had happened. What time was he healed? He was healed at the seventh hour, and that was exactly the time, he remembers, Jesus said, it's done. It's done. The assurance of it all, okay? Sorry about the misspelling on the official. spent the night wrestling with fears. And again, we spend the night between promise and fulfillment. So I'm going to suggest to you that from the narrative, I see him, the Father, moving from I've got nothing to lose to believing in the words of Jesus to, and then this is what happened. The end of the narrative says, he and his whole household believed. It had an effect, not just on the Father. It had an effect on all his household. Because he was revered, he was esteemed. They saw their father, who the week before was heavy into politics and money and human power. And then his son was about to die. And then that changed things. And he dared to step out from human ways of living life and dared to go to the rabbi and say, you need to heal my son. And he did. And he found out the next day. He and his whole household were healed. Anything else you'd like to add? Anything you want to do? Sorry, I've silenced you. I apologize. Yes. Well, he already knew something about Jesus because Herodians were after him, but. Yes, what was his faith? Yeah, he had faith that Jesus could heal. He was a healer. Yeah. Right. He made a progression, and it all happened within 24 hours. Yeah. Well, he chose to believe. He chose to believe. He made that walk home. He chose to believe. See, belief is not just an emotional response. Belief is a... That's right. Well, right. Our faith needs to be both emotional and intellectual. He chose to believe Jesus and make a 20-mile walk that took a day. Yeah. Thank you. It seemed appropriate for what I had just seen with Mitch and Leah. That's why I skipped. Sorry. Thank you for your comment. Any other comments on this text here? All right. It's 2 minutes till. So I'm going to go ahead and just read chapter 5, the beginning, and read those verses that follow. Let me put it this way. What you will see now as you continue into John, past chapter 4, into chapter 5, chapter 5. In the year of popularity, Jesus will come to a point where he has to cross the Rubicon. I think I've used this illustration before. The Rubicon is a river, a little teeny river in Italy. And the only reason that phrase is even known in history is because a famous Roman general by the name of Julius Caesar decided to cross it. You see, there was a law in ancient Rome. All successful Roman generals had to leave their loyal troops far away from Rome so they wouldn't be tempted to turn their loyalty of their troops into, I'm going to take over power in Rome. So the law was, keep your troops over the Rubicon. Well, Julius Caesar knew, as he had spent 2 years in fighting the Gauls in France, what we call France today, he had known that his used-to-be friend, now enemy, Pompey, another successful general, had allied himself with another senators in Rome, and they were conspiring to charge him with treason, and for him to walk into Rome without his troops was going to be absolute suicide, politically speaking and physically too. And so he crossed the Rubicon with his troops. You see, once you cross that river as a Roman general, you can't come back. You violated a long-standing rule of the Roman Republic, and you can't come back from that. There are certain things in life that once you cross, you can't come back. Jesus is not having second thoughts or doubts, but he will remember with the Father say, is there any way to end this story any other way than going to the cross? Jesus will cross the Rubicon. Chapter 5 is that point where he's going to incur the wrath of his enemies fully. And so that's where you're going to be moving to after you go back next Sunday and do the Nicodemus and the woman at the well. Thank you very much for your attention today.